Hey everybody, welcome to another exciting, intriguing, and fun episode of the OIG Roundtable. Got the whole team here today. We got a great topic we're going to be talking about. I've got, of course, my three compadres, Jason Eisengrein, retired senior leader from HHS OIG, and the now retired Western UPIC director and our special director in charge of special projects. His counterpart, Matt Kuchanski, also retired from HHS OIG, the Northeast UPIC director and our manager of our SIU team, and Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and a member of our investigative team. So it's good to have the band all together for today's topic. So today we're going to go back and talk a little bit more in depth about on-sites. I know we talked about these in a previous podcast. We kind of talked about what to do, what not to do. We talked about having policies about on-sites and the like. But one of the things that's become a piece of the puzzle in the current climate in the SIU space is going back and doing on-sites, right? So during the public health emergency and COVID, there was essentially a moratorium on the CMS side. CMS was directing the UPICs not to go out and do on-sites. A lot of the commercial payers, the Medicaids, were not doing them. OIG was very limited in how it was operating from a law enforcement perspective, as well as other law enforcement agencies, and that created some inherent challenges. But now that we're coming out of this, you know, the prospect of going back and doing on-sites comes into play. But, you know, the big thing, and we've seen it here at Advise, is that a large number of SIUs and in the payment integrity space, as well as I think generally in the business sense, is that people move to a remote working environment. And to a large extent, that remote working environment stayed for a lot of businesses. We see that in the SIU space. We see it with our own team. We see it with a lot of our clients and our partners. We all work remotely, and that's going to have some effect. So, Wade, I want to start with you, because you actually were the one that brought this up about this whole premise of being in this remote environment. And there are some inherent issues with working in a remote environment, not just from the on-site, right? And first and foremost is just the working environment. So I think we have to talk about that from an SIU or payment integrity operational perspective, is that there are challenges in working in a remote environment to start with, and then we'll take it to talking about how that parlays itself into doing on-sites. But certainly there are challenges in that remote space as the kind of the foundation for it.
Yeah, I think investigators are probably, a little less, there's a little bit less of a team environment when you can always pick up the phone and call somebody, but it's different where you're in an office next to somebody or a cubicle, where you're probably more likely to, talk through a situation, get advice, ask questions, that type of thing, I think technology is getting better, where even just having like Teams where it's easy to do a video call, you can still kind of get that same environment, but it's still working remote. I think there really is a big difference as far as how you react with others and get advice from them. Now, if you remember back to, I don't know what year it was, but 15 or 20 years ago, almost, with OI, we paid a ton of money for this networking system so you could have conference calls and things of that nature. When I retired, we didn't have the ability to have video calls just at the push of a button. So I think technology is really helping that remote work situation be a little bit more like an in-person situation, just because of things like Teams and FaceTime and whatever system you use. But I still think there is a little bit of a hindrance when you're not in the same location with other people working the same types of cases.
Yeah, and the challenge, is that over the years, technology has gotten better, but we still tend to work a lot more texting and email and things of that sort, and so that live interaction tends to be a little bit of a challenge. And I think, collaterally, what wound up happening is, right, the job market shifted and changed, right? And people entered into the SIU space or went back to it or what have you. And so you've also got, a number of people who are now in this space who probably have never done an on-site before the world of COVID. And now, right, so you got to train people, you got to get them up to speed, you got to get them educated. And that presents a whole other set of circumstances, because you've got a group of people who may not be inordinately conversant in doing on-sites and talking to people and doing that. And, you know, we do a bunch of training in doing interviews, and we do them, we train people on sort of best practices for interviews that are done in person, telephonically, and we've started to do even how to do interviews over Teams or, you know, Zoom or, you know, one of those platforms. But the technology has created an environment where working remotely for the most part is not a problem. It's when it comes time to do an on-site and you've got these situations of people being in, in disparate locations. So Matt, I want to go to you because, you know, that becomes a piece of the puzzle. And, you know, we've got one client in particular that we've done some work for where they only had two investigators in a particular state. And, you know, we learned that they were sending their two investigators out to do on-site. So you've got a whole host of issues there from safety perspectives, but also the ability to actually conduct an effective on-site when you've got these limited resources.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you have to really, really pick and choose what cases you want to use these resources for on-sites, because they are expensive, they are resource intensive. If you've got two people, you have to make the initial decision, are they even possible to do, you know, safely and effectively, because you've got X number of interviews that you have to do, record pulls, you know, looking at the office, you know, depending on the type of case, checking out the equipment, doing the, you know, making the calibration checks on the equipment, all of those things. You know, can two people do those effectively and safely? And if they can, how long is it going to take them? Are you talking 1 or 2 or 3 days on site with overnight, you know, lodging costs and per diem and all of those things, plus having two people totally dedicated to that and ignoring the rest of their caseload for that amount of time? You really have to be careful up front as to what cases merit an on-site visit, you know. And, you know, what are you getting out of that visit that you couldn't get simply from a request letter or a Teams interview with the provider or their billing manager or whatever? You know, to use your parlance, is the juice worth the squeeze?
And so, wait, I want to go back to you because, you know, Matt brought up a good point, which is that, you know, what is the right number, right? Two people is, we could certainly say it's never one. And two is probably not the right number because you've got to have multiple things going on when you're doing an on-site, like interviews and such. And interviews should generally not be with one person. Interviews of, you know, if we're talking about interviews of members where you're getting basic information, those are probably okay. But when you start to get into interviews of current employees, former employees, the provider, things of that sort, those really need to be done with a witness. So wait, I just want to go back to you for a minute before I go to Jason, which is this whole premise of resource allocation, right? And, you know, I guess we think of on-sites very similarly to the way we would think about doing a search warrant or something like that. And it's not obviously in that same vein, right? It's not a law enforcement operation, but there's certainly the from a logistics perspective, there are certain things that you have to think about, and there are certain things that you have to take into consideration when you are deciding to do an on-site. So, you know, put your ASAC hat back on, because these really are similar conversations. What are some of the logistical considerations that need to be taken into effect to do an on-site?
Well, and it depends on if we're talking about like a mom and pop, you know, doctor's office where it's one doctor and a secretary versus, you know, someplace that has multiple locations. So now you go in and, you know, you might be looking for certain records and they might be, well, they're at our, you know, our headquarters, you know, 100 miles away. I mean, you have to work all that out before you do the on-site. But, you know, beyond just the logistics of how big is the place, like you said, you need several people to do interviews. You know, you need to have kind of a safety, you don't necessarily have to have like a guard, but you have to have safety in mind. And I think to not only to the point where like at Advise where we work remotely, but I think a lot of the SIUs are working remotely. I think going back to the, you know, is it worth it? The juice worth the squeeze? I really think that if it gets to a point where you need to do an on-site, it's almost like you have to really consider, is this something we need to refer to you know, the Mufuku or somebody who has those resources. They have the government cars, they have law enforcement authority. It's really gets to a point where it's difficult for contractors to be able to come up with those resources to do it effectively. And I mean, if you're just going to you know, like you say, maybe calibrate a machine or something like that, but if you're looking for records and conducting interviews and everything like that, it's probably something that maybe needs to be referred on to, you know, law enforcement.
Right. And the real challenge is that if your SIU team is all over the country and you need to do an on-site, or you feel like you need to do an on-site, right? What Matt's talking about is some of these financial considerations that, you know, that work into that. So Jason, I want to go to you because that really gets to this whole premise of policies, procedures, and that ROI. And, you know, having been at the forefront as the director of a UPIC where budget was at the forefront, and it's a combination of appropriate resources and resource allocation. But what are some of the things that you're thinking of from that resource allocation, that ROI perspective, that's really got to be taken into consideration when making a decision to do an on-site where you've got to bring in those resources to help facilitate it?
Well, keep your finger on the mute button because, you know, there's a lot to offer on this. Everything that everyone has said is absolutely true, but two things can be true at the same time. The end of the story, though, so that, you know, it gets in before you tap the mute button, is that this is all about case management. Every investigator worth his or her salt thinks like that investigation that they've committed to is the one that's going to need all those resources. You know, we really do have to go to Guam, which is in the jurisdiction of the UPIC West, and was a true story. So yeah, you really got to go to Guam, and guess what? It's a different day there. It's 25 hours to get there and whatever. And, you know, the investigator probably thinks like, yeah, I got my BDUs ready. I've had all my shots. I'm ready to go. The reality is it takes a case manager to assess whether or not, okay, I'll do it, the juice is worth the squeeze, you know, or are you just going to end up with a lot of heartburn from drinking way too much orange juice early in the morning? So, you know, you got to have somebody as the control rod assessing whether that's worth it or not. However, conceptually, I think artificial intelligence algorithms, they're all great. We've talked about this on other podcasts. But we cannot dispense with human intelligence in lieu of, you know, anything else. I mean, it just is so important to lay your hands and eyes on the actual situation. It just totally changes the dynamic. I mean, how many times all of us as agents, you know, you gotta go out and do a drive-by. Now, maybe you didn't need 24 drive-bys, but you know, it was always amazing to me how many times, like when you physically lay your eyes on a situation, it totally adjusts the picture. Now, bringing it up to the operational level, in the mid-90s, OI said, we're going to have at least two agents in every state. And of course, that became untenable from a budget point, and it had to reduce. And to your points where, is two really the right number? I mean, you know, when I spoke to the agents up in Sioux Falls and, you know, going to a very remote part of the state, a reservation with no telephone communication, no radio communication, how do you manage that? So, you know, it probably doesn't make sense to have people in the jurisdiction. The Western jurisdiction for the UPIC has 13 states and three Pacific territories that you talk about disparate locations. It's just incredible. But there's another concept, and I'll leave it with this, even though I have a lot more. I know you're going to hit that mute button, is that all fraud is local. You know, when you're looking at it and you say, well, wait a minute, this, you know, $200,000 at risk in Wyoming just isn't worth it. You know, and then you actually realize, you know, there are some other issues that, again, it's about case prioritization, and that's case management. It has to do with like a you know, patient harm issue or something like that, and you go in and you do it, and you actually end up with a $200,000 recovery. And organizationally, and frankly at CMS, it's like 200 grand. Is that really what we're paying you for? But at that state level, they just about wanted to hold a parade over that 200 grand. So you got to keep it in perspective of where it's actually happening and what your responsibilities are as an organization.
Well, and the big point there that you just made is that it's going to be client specific, right? I mean, even as an SIU, you're oftentimes, you know, you've got different operational things going on with different plans. And so that $200,000 may be nothing in the drop in the bucket in the world of CMS, but to a state's Medicaid plan, $200,000 exactly. could be a huge change. So Matt, I want to go to you for the last bit of this, because some of this is also in that vetting and determining when when that juice is worth the squeeze, right? So, you know, we're seeing a lot of instances coming in for us where providers are billing for what appears to be greater than a 24-hour period on E&Ms. And, you know, we have one client which just sent us some work to do, and the algorithm showed that there was a, you know, greater than 24-hour amount of time spent on E&Ms. And I went back and I said to the plan that we're doing the work for, I said, well, you know, E&Ms are not time-based anymore. It's medical decision-making. And so have you looked to scrub this data a little more as best you can to identify that juice is worth the squeeze, right? So that becomes an important piece of it. It's not just all of these other things. It's, you know, if we're going to go out and do an on-site and expend those resources, are we spending more resources than what it's going to wind up resolving?
Oh, absolutely. If you fall into the whole trap of this is a big case because I got big data and it, you know, this is the biggest biller and all that stuff, you have to delve deeply into the data, and do the due diligent work to make sure that this case is what you think it is. The interviews, the research that you're going to do on policies and regulations, perhaps member interviews, and just make an informed decision of, is this case of enough priority and of the right nature to put those resources into something like an on-site? Because Jason is right. There's no more powerful tool. I know it's a rare day. No more powerful tool for an investigative arm than an on-site, because it is akin to a search warrant. You're going to accomplish three things when you do an on-site. You're going to quicken the pace of the investigation because you're doing a whole bunch of things at one time. You're interviewing a lot of people at once. You're gathering the records. You've got your eyes on the provider and you're seeing what's going on there. So you're building up in the investigator's mind what the true picture is of the environment and of the provider's office. You're also showing that provider, hey, we mean business here. You know, you've got a serious problem if we're showing up on site, especially, you know, in an environment post-COVID where everybody's spread out and they're not used to seeing these things. You show up on site, that provider's, you know, there's a pucker factor there, and you gain that from there. And the third thing is, you know, as an investigator, you're gathering a whole lot of knowledge and information that you can then put into an investigative plan that's going to bring this thing to a quicker conclusion. You know, and those are all positives. But again, before you get to that point, you have to make those decisions based on the facts that you're gathering. You know, is this the type of case we need to do this on? Is it an E&M case where you can do a medical review and get an overpayment? Or is it a services not rendered matter where they don't even have the equipment there to do the tests that they're billing for? Is it, you know, they're billing for hundreds of patients a day and you walk in there and it's a, you know, their office is a Wally Watt shed that, you know, that has two people in it, you know? You have to really do the upfront work to make sure that it's going to be effective.
Right. And I think that, you know, the thing that you said, which is the important piece of that, is that the allegation
was important.
Well, all of it was important, but the allegation can really be the driving factor behind that. Because, right, if it's a case of upcoding E&Ms, is doing an on-site going to achieve anything other than get you medical records that you would have gotten anyway, whether they're fabricated or not, it's another story. And we can go on about ways to identify if a record's fabricated, right? Some masking that you can do and requesting records. But yeah, there is a discernible difference between doing an on-site for a provider who upcoded E&Ms and had an impossible day versus a provider who was doing, you know, TCD, right? Transcranial Dopplers, and doesn't have the machine to do it, right? Or whatever it may be. And that becomes a huge driving factor. So you got to make that becomes, I think, to me, one of the top considerations is why would we do an on-site? And then, you know, you're doing it because of these factors. And then what's that benefit analysis, cost benefit analysis to do that? So yeah, it's definitely a metric that you have to look at. So great stuff always. You know, I think as we continue to morph and evolve out of COVID, we'll continue to have conversations about how the COVID stuff, because the juice is worth the squeeze when Jason has it, we'll continue to have these conversations about how those all factor in. So thanks as always to everybody for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed, by the way, I hope everybody enjoyed our LinkedIn Live for April that we just did. Great discussion. It was one of our more populated and well-attended events. We had well over 200 people attend on this and probably even more, because we do deploy this over a couple of different platforms, but just on the LinkedIn Live, we had well over 200. We're still doing the analytics and that. So thanks very much. We've got an amazing LinkedIn Live scheduled for May. We're going to be doing a deep dive into investigations, auditing, and documentation in the behavioral health space. Two of our great subject matter experts in behavioral health will be discussing some of those issues from a coding and documentation perspective, an auditing perspective, and also from the investigative perspective. So thanks for that. If you have not been up to our website lately, we do have a brand new refreshed with a great look on our website. You can get to our newsletter right from the website. You can sign up for it. We have our own page, the OIG Roundtable. We've got our own page. You can get all of our previous LinkedIn Lives and ORG roundtables there, but you can still get us at hello@advizehealth.com. You can get the newsletter by signing up through that email or just reach out to us. So as always, we appreciate everybody's time, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.